The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name, inevitably, is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're @NewsTalkScience. And we get to loads of those comments and we hold forth in a way liked by some and loathed by others at the end of the podcast. First, though, it's time to tell you what's coming up on this week's episode. It is all about the science of contagion and how things spread. We're going to be speaking to Adam Kucharski about the coronavirus, but also how other things spread and what to do about them. Now, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Now it's clear to me what it should have done. But hindsight is 20/20. I don't know anymore. What's if you've just listened to this program, we've been doing this news round idea for 10 years. And the idea is that we play a clip that's relevant to the first story, and that can be quite eclectic. And I think we've just, and that this idea has run its course. because there's just
shark.
Random stuff comes out when we say our first story. So our first story has to do with, what was that, George Benson? It was George Benson.
Gosh.
I don't even know
who George Benson
slash funk.
Is.
So this first story has to do with 2020 vision, and it's to do with eye movements.
I just think this
story.
I think this is class, this story. It was published in Nature Communications. Our visual acuity is how we see things and make them out in detail. So a friend's face from across the room, or what people will be very familiar with is that chart when you go to an optician's and you read the letters all the way down. And it was always thought to be based on, obviously, the structure of your eye itself and then the quality of the retina at the back of the eye. And this new paper has shown very well that it's also to do with the movements, these micro little movements of your eyes that happen all the time that we don't obviously notice, we don't take in our, and when we are visualizing things, we don't feel like they're moving. But it is hugely reliant on these. And you can actually do an experiment at home, please not if you're driving, but if you guys do it here, just cover one of your eyes. So pick whichever one, it doesn't matter. And then take your thumb and your index finger and hold your other eyeball, put it on top of your upper lid and on the bottom of your lower lid, and hold your eyeball completely still. Obviously, your eyelid has to be open. So look at something. Don't move.
It's defocused.
And hold it completely still and just wait. And what actually happens is if you keep doing that, hold your eye completely still, it will actually start to go black. And it's a little bit akin to when you walk into a room and there's a bad smell.
Oh my God, I'm going blind. What the hell are you doing?
It disappears. So you just hold your eyeball completely still, and the image will totally disappear. And it's because, so if you walk into a room with a really bad smell, your body keeps sending that same sense to your brain over and over again for a couple of minutes. And your brain eventually says, look, ignore it. It's not new. I don't care. And that's the same idea with this. When you hold your eyeball completely still, your brain just keeps seeing the same image on your retina. And it just goes, look, I have no time for this anymore. If you're not going to change the information you're sending me, I'm not going to listen to you. So this is what they found, that they had people look at these, what we call Snellen charts, which are the letters in the...
Snellen chart.
It actually spells out Snellen. No, it doesn't.
It does not.
These are the reading charts you
the
see.
The reading
in...
charts. So a big A, then a small like G, F. And you're supposed to read all the way down. And most people can read 8 lines. And that's what Americans call 20/20 vision. We don't use feet. We use meters in Ireland. So it's 6/6. But I know.
I know that.
I know, it's very boring. Everyone still wants to say 20/20, so it's more fun to say it like that. But what they did was they got a digital image of a Snellen chart, and every time your eye did a little micro movement, they also moved the Snellen chart so that the exact picture was always being projected onto your retina. So it never moved.
How the hell did they do that?
That's the coolest part, I actually think, of the whole thing. Like, they literally just kept moving the digital image while also making sure that it was completely in line with the tiny movements of the eye.
Wow.
And they found that if most people who are this kind of 20/20 vision, they can read 8 lines on this chart, they actually lost 2 full lines. And I just think that's absolutely fascinating. You'd think we would have known this by now. And it has huge repercussions because, for instance, people with Parkinson's can often get quite poor eyesight. And it was never really known why, but it's obviously a movement disorder. And if your eyes can't move, as well as also having a good retina and, you know, the well-shaped cornea and everything, then you can't see as well as other people. Dyslexia is another thing where they think that there's potentially disjointed movements. So wouldn't this be just the simplest way to correct some visual acuity problems? Just train eyes and like strengthen up their movements rather than surgery or all the things. I just think it's absolutely amazing. How did they not know this?
It's amazing.
Like, yeah, see your eyes.
These are called saccades, is that right?
Yeah, so well, saccades is the kind of rhythmic movements of the eyes. So these are called fixational movements of the eyes.
Okay.
So it's the same idea. Like your eye is always, always, always moving to continuously...
compare and contrast.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And I'm blown away.
That's a great story.
I think it's cool.
I have a pain in my eyeball now from holding it. Is that something I should be concerned about?
So, just
News
be careful.
Talk would like to distance itself
exactly.
from any potential medical implications for that experiment.
Sorry about that, guys.
Our second story has to do with solar-powered fresh water.
Yeah, absolutely. So having secure sources of fresh water are hugely important. And it's become one of those things now where we joke and say that the wars of the 21st century will be about water as opposed to the 20th century ones on oil. So access to clean water is incredibly important. So there is so much water in the sea. Why can't we drink it? We can't drink it because it's 2 or 3% salt, and that will make you sick. And so there are mechanisms to turn that salty water fresh. And so what you do is you boil it, and then you catch the evaporate and you distill it in the same way you make alcohol. And
so you keep the salt is at the bottom and the steam is pure water.
Absolutely.
You hit it to a cold piece of glass or something and catch it. Yeah.
And that's the basis of this paper that's been published by people at MIT working with Chinese scientists.
Wait a second. You don't need to go to MIT or work with Chinese scientists to figure that out. What is the...
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of like...
But that's the basic principle, right? Oh, is that okay. you can evaporate salty water and you can catch the evaporate, condense it and use that as fresh water. But they're doing it in a certain way where you think, well, how do I heat the water up in the first place, right? They're actually using black materials that are out in the ocean. They're catching light from the sun that heats up water that has been captured, and then it causes it to evaporate and condense. And then, crucially, they're able to repeat this process 10 times. The new bit of science here is that when water condenses, it gives out energy, right? Because there is more energy in the evaporate, in a gas, than there is in a liquid. And so that energy has to go somewhere. And usually that just goes out into the ether. So in this device, what they have done is they've been able to harness the energy given off by the first condensation to fuel the next evaporation.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's kind of one feeds the next. And it's very efficient because they're using clever materials. And so they have done this 10 times in the device that they built. And they're able to, from 1 meter square of this device, they're able to get 6 liters of water. Huh.
In a day.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's a lot.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's way more than you need. Because I don't know if you saw that.
No, this is another thing, right? We are told we need 2 to 3 litres of water a day. You don't necessarily. The amount of water you should drink a day is the amount that you feel you need, unless you're an old person and you've lost your thirst, right?
Yes. Yes, I felt this so strongly and I've been bombarded by hydration. My wife has a hydration app which reminds me you need to drink water.
Do
not laugh at my wife.
Sorry, Dara.
I can laugh at the wife. You cannot.
We're trained to laugh at people.
my former radio wife, Claire McKenna, was big on this hydration thing. There's so much stuff about your food is 50% water. You are nearly 100% water. Like, we are not.
My favourite is 8 glasses. Do you remember that? 8 glasses. You're like, how big is a glass?
If you're thirsty, your body's saying you need water.
The only people that do well out of this are companies that sell bottled water. Right?
Yeah.
The idea that you can't walk the length of the Dunleary Pier without a glass of water or a bottle of water in your hand is madness, right? So, yes, these people, though, have made, a reliable source of fresh water. Crucially, and I think this is amazing as Jonathan takes a drink, is that they've been able to make a device for $100 and they've been able to make it with sort of things that you'd find, you know, that they're not, there's nothing in here materials-wise that's crazy.
No. What do you mean things that you'd find?
So nothing in here is an advanced material, right, okay. Is what I'm trying to say. Okay. Sorry. So they have a very black material for the initial absorption of heat, and then they use regular plastic for the various layers. And they use tissue paper to cause the capillary action to suck or to force the water from the sea up into the device. So they capture a certain amount of water from the sea, then that's evaporated, condensed, and so forth. It's amazing.
High concept, low tech. That's the way forward.
It is.
That's amazing.
Mm.
Okay, our third story has to do with revenge.
So let me ask you guys. I'm pitching you a TV show. And there's three different endings, and I want you to pick the one you think is going to be the most enjoyable to watch. Okay, so the one you think is going to be the most fun. So a colleague of yours, or if someone steals 50 euro from your desk.
I know who that is, by the way. Yeah.
It was Jonathan. And so in the first scenario, say you're the person who was robbed from, and you think, look, you know, poor them, they probably needed it for something, I'm going to take them out for coffee, and that's the end of the show. In the second one, you go over and they have a 50 euro bottle of whiskey in one of their drawers, you thieve it back, and that's it, that's the end of the show. In the third one, you go back, you steal 50 euro from their desk, you download a bunch of porn onto their work computer, and you get them fired. Which show of these do you want to watch the most? Which is the most?
The last one I want to watch. I mean, I don't want it to happen.
I'm actually looking. Shane might not. He's. I kind of want to watch the last show. What would you want to watch?
I suppose it's not real life. So you'd watch the last one because it sounds like.
And what do you think would be the most meaningful or thought provoking of them all? You know, the person who maybe took them for the coffee and forgave them, or the middle retribution?
No, the middle one, where it's an eye for an eye.
Yeah, sort of. Okay. Yeah. Well, that is basically what they asked 184 college students over in the States, and they said basically what you're saying, Jonathan. So the most people liked the middle one, which they call equitable retribution, but the people who thought the most thought-provoking and the potentially most meaningful was where someone kind of turned the other cheek. But the one that everybody wanted to watch and that came out by far and away the most fun or enjoyable was the over-retribution. So it was
It's a whole genre. It's a whole genre of 1970s movies, blaxploitation and exploitation. The whole idea was something happened to someone and then the revenge that was
absolutely
endless and gruesome, often starring women who'd been horribly maligned in some way at the beginning of the movie and then just like giving them full power to destroy.
Yeah, people are fascinated by it, aren't they? And that's the whole moral of this as well. Everybody, they're not saying that they thought it was right, it was thought-provoking, but they all thought it'd be the most fun. Everybody wanted to see that story.
Tarantino did two movies about the Death Proof and then Roberto Rodriguez's. There's sort of a double bill horror show, but there's a whole whole subgenre of horror revenge slasher films that are about people just going crazy
after they've been marginally wrong.
Well, no, not always marginally wrong, but always the, you know, it's the most gruesome death of not just you but everyone you know.
I'm fascinated because I don't really love that kind of genre, and people seem to be absolutely
it's often a bit grotesque. It's a bit and it's always really gratuitous in the violence, but some people are into it. But I get the idea that if someone starts something, because the game theory goes is about this, isn't it? It's about figuring out how do you get your best outcome. Mm. So if someone attacks you first, do you just attack them back, or you know how do
or
you
or do you turn do you the respond? Other cheek and realize that sometimes people act out for terrible reasons?
I mean, you know, I often think if people rob something from you, I think they probably needed it.
They
more
maybe
than
needed
I
it. Yeah. So maybe we should consider that as well. I don't know. It's interesting. Well, college students in America do not care about that. They just want.
Well, they are generally quite
revenge.
Privileged.
Grindhouse
so.
Was the movie. Grindhouse. Thanks for that, Aidan. Okay, our final story has to do with rowdy cows.
Teenage cows. It's like the new version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So they have looked at. There's a whole genre of science called cow psychology.
What?
Actually,
I can see why there would be, yeah.
Perhaps. And so there are 6 million cows in Ireland. Perhaps some of them are listening because I know that people play radio to cows when they're being milked. But I guess the time this show goes out, no cow in Ireland's being milked. So anyway, cows can, it turns out, they can have a teenage phase, right? So do you know how long a cow can live? I didn't know this because most of them...
40 years? About
20 years, right?
I was going to say about 10.
they will go a little earlier if they're going to the burger factory. But if you leave a cow in its natural habitat, a field near my house, they'll live for 20 years. And so these guys in Canada have looked at Holstein dairy cows and they've looked at how they behave at certain periods in their lives. And so they followed a herd and they looked at them at 1 month, 3 months, a year and 2.5 years. And they put these cows into a sort of a new scenario at each stage. So there was a new stimulus each time, and they looked and they measured how they were, how their bravery was being, like were they being brave or were they not being brave? Were they being adventurous with this new stimulus, right? And they saw that They were quite reliable while they were calves and then while they were adults. But in the intervening years, in the middle bit, they're calling this the teenage years, that's when they were unpredictable. And they're saying that cows, like many other species, may have that teenage hormonal issue going on where they're just a little bit more all over the place hormonally. And so they're going to act out in unusual
ways.
What
does this acting out look like?
So that they will be perhaps far more brave or far less brave.
What does that look like, though, cow being brave?
They normally just stare and look at you. But I suppose these teenage cows are more likely in some scenarios to kind of be really provocative and come over and get involved or to run away.
I once went to a party in Meath and I left my car in the field. And when I came to go back, I couldn't find it. All I could see was a big herd of cows. And then I realised they were all licking my Opel Corsa.
They love licking things.
Well, do not leave your Opel Corsa in a field.
It's probably cleaner afterwards.
Listen, good luck.
Yeah.
Let's hope we don't see you next week.
I know.
Let's
I really hope I don't see you guys next week. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think you're going to be a fantastic mother.
Thanks, buddy. That's so nice.
I'm not
Shane
entirely
doesn't.
Sure if I feel
I do.
That,
I do.
I've say it.
You do have to say it. Fingers crossed I don't see you next week. And if I do, I'm going to be pretty miserable.
Good luck, woman.
Thanks. Thank you so
Lots
much.
Lots of love from everybody to you.
I'll let you know when it comes.
It's going to be a breeze. Thanks, thanks, guys. All right, coming up, the science of contagion and how things spread. Now, with over 50,000 cases and more than 1,300 deaths recorded to date, the spread of the coronavirus is understandably a story that's dominating the headlines worldwide. Governments, medical professionals, and even military personnel have been deployed to limit the impact of this epidemic. But all of this work is itself reliant on the effort of mathematicians. But how? Well, Adam Kucharski is Associate Professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's author of a new book called The Rules of Contagion. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Hi, thank you.
So when we think about the spread of a disease, you know, there's so many different factors in whether or not something becomes a huge, you know, Spanish flu sort of a deal or peters out. How much is that grounded in just simple maths?
I think there's obviously a lot of things going on during outbreaks, but we can distill it down to a few key numbers that really tell us a lot about the situation. I mean, one of the key values we look at early on in an outbreak is what we call the reproduction number. And that's for each case that's infectious, how many people on average are they giving it to? And so if you have a situation where the reproduction number is above one, with each round of infection, you're going to have more cases than you had before, and you'd expect growth. So for the coronavirus outbreak, in the early stages, we were getting a reproduction of about two. So with each kind of round of infection, you're potentially doubling the size of your outbreak.
So, I mean, that's an exponential growth, and that is really dangerous, right?
Exactly. And that's something, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, it very quickly grows. But it's not just the amount of growth that we are concerned about. It's also the speed at which that happens. So if you have one case appearing, how long does it take for the person they affect to appear as a case? And we call that the generation time. And for the current outbreak, it's about 7 days. But for other viruses or even other forms of contagion, online contagion, that gap might be very different. So although we have this kind of exponential growth, the timescale on which that happens is obviously really important too.
Was that one of the issues with, say, the plague?
I mean, that's one thing with a whole bunch of kind of historical infections. It's not just kind of how much transmission is happening at the individual level, but actually the kind of timescales we're dealing with. Really, a lot of that can also just be driven by interactions that we saw with kind of historical epidemics, Black Death, plague, this sort of thing, that actually the spread across Europe, for example, took kind of months and years. And a lot of that was to do with the nature of interactions, whereas now we see something that can spread globally really within a matter of days and weeks. So it's really not just about the kind of the virus or the bacteria itself, but also about how people are behaving and interacting.
Do we fully understand transmission and the mechanism of transmission yet? We did a piece, got to be 4 years ago now, on the science of sneezing. And the lengths that we sneeze blew my mind. Like, in some cases, we're talking 5 or 6 meters for some of the particles we're talking about. And that is, you know, when previously you think, oh, a sneeze might get, you know, people a few feet away from you. When you're talking 5 to 8 meters, that is an extraordinary distance to watch your disease.
And I think there's still a lot of things to learn about actually, if we're looking at the kind of the small scale mechanics of how these things disperse, and, you know, if if something lingers in the air. I think what we are getting much better at is understanding the implications of that for an outbreak. Right. If you look, for example, if you have situations where you have a pocket of people who are susceptible to measles, we saw it at an airline terminal a few years ago, that a huge number of people are infected because, you know, a sneeze or something can just go that far. But then we see for other infections, which are kind of much more droplets or close contact, although you can't work out exactly who'll be infected, you can have a better sense of what kind of social interaction environments are going to be more suitable for that.
In the book, you kind of make the comparison between sort of online not viruses as in computer viruses, but ideas and so on that follow similar patterns of contagion. And you talk about this idea of a reproduction number also applying to online ideas like the ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of data in recent years that allows us to kind of measure these online outbreaks and compare them to what we see in biological infections. There's been a lot of studies. There's actually the neck nomination, if you remember, the precursor to the ice bucket challenge a few years ago, where people were kind of downing pints and filming themselves and sticking it online.
Yeah.
It was seeing that really sparked my curiosity in these online outbreaks, because for real diseases, we don't really know what the reproduction number is. We've got to try and estimate it. And we don't really know the timescale. But if you remember, for that game of the ice bucket challenge, everyone had to nominate a couple of other people and everyone had 24 hours to do it.
Yeah.
So those kind of two values that are really tough to estimate were kind of just part of the game. And I ran a very quick simulation when it started, and it showed that it would basically burn out in about 2-3 weeks, which is what we saw in the UK. And people subsequently did for the ice bucket challenge these kind of disease models that actually captured what was going on very nicely. And I think that showed to me that there are these elements that are kind of predictable for these outbreaks. And there was a nice analysis that is actually some Facebook researchers did a couple of years ago, and they looked at the most popular, most shared content on Facebook. So really, like, you know, the super contagious ideas. But they found all of them actually had a reproduction number of about 2. So these things aren't, you know, highly contagious, that are, on average, people aren't spreading them that much. And really, a lot of the things going viral is more down to the speed at which that sharing's happening,
right,
that exponential growth happening, and the fact you've got these individual hubs, or if you like to think of it, in the network. So, you know, media agencies or celebrities, which can spread it much, much further. But actually, if you look at the average person, the level of transmission for kind of super popular Facebook content is pretty similar to a lot of biological infections.
Right. And you talk about this reproduction number for Ebola and for this coronavirus as being around 2. Are there diseases that we've seen which haven't ended up decimating populations, but have a number that's like 5 or 6 or 10 that if they got into the major population, it would be the end of the human race? Have we seen anything like that?
There's a few that we've kind of managed to get rid of through things like vaccination. So smallpox had a reproduction number of about 5 in a kind of susceptible population. But obviously, back in the 60s, 70s, through vaccination campaigns, it reduced the effective reproduction number, because it sort of removed the amount of proportion of people who are susceptible. So I think that's the most common example of something that, in theory.
Wow. And so, I mean, yeah, if you think of a reproduction number of 5 with today's sort of travel, if there was another smallpox, with the amount of traveling, has anyone ever done the simulation of what that would look like in terms of how quickly that would spread, or how you would stop something like that?
They did. And in the, certainly in the kind of early noughties, so after 9/11, there was a lot of concern about kind of bioterror attacks. There were anthrax attacks in the US, and there were a lot of questions about.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, go on.
About whether, you know, smallpox, because it's that we know of, it's only samples only remain in 2 labs, but there were kind of questions of maybe it's somehow got its way into bad hands. And there was a lot of concern about if this is released, you know, should we vaccinate people? What do we do? And actually, for smallpox, it had some features that made it reasonably easier to control than other infections. And one is that people have very distinctive symptoms and are generally only infectious when they have those symptoms. So it's easy to spot cases and track down people they've come in contact with. Compare that to something like flu, where people are walking around, they might have a bit of a sniffle, but they're not really ill, shedding virus everywhere. That's much, much harder to control.
When we talk about viruses, sometimes we describe something called the viral load. And does that have an effect on contagion, the amount of that virus in your body during the course of that disease?
It does. There's one of the ways in which we use that value is it can be an indication of how much virus people might be shedding when they're kind of coughing and sneezing. If you have a very low viral load, there's not a lot of virus in your system, so you would expect there to be less infection. And some diseases, for example, Ebola, really the viral load shoots up very late in the infection when people get severely ill. So that's the period where there's the highest risk and individuals are most infectious. But for other things, for example, with flu, we might actually see people who are shedding virus but aren't severely ill. And actually, by the time people are kind of coughing and spluttering, they might have done a lot of the transmission that they're going to do already.
How come some of the projections we make when it comes to a disease go really badly wrong? Like Ebola would be a good example of that.
We see sometimes very high profile projections. One of the ones in Ebola put forward this estimate that there'd be 1.5 million cases. I think one of the tough things with kind of developing forecasts for disease outbreaks compared to, say, the weather is if you come up with a bad weather forecast, that won't have any effect on the weather. But of course, if you come up with some prediction that this disease is going to be a big problem, that can in some cases, stimulate a response that people go in and control it. So to some extent, coming up with predictions where it's reasonable to say if the situation continued, you'd have a problem. And if that persuades people to fix the problem, your prediction is going to be wrong. But in a way, that's still a kind of useful cycle to have. I think the danger, though, is when you're dealing with things that have exponential growth, you know, if you're kind of doubling and doubling and doubling, even if you just kind of stick that into a spreadsheet, very quickly you get numbers that are kind of implausibly large. And there was one, going back to the smallpox example, where people, a group estimated that if smallpox was released by terrorists, it could infect 77 trillion people.
well, which that's a lot of people. I'm no mathematician. So one of the points made about this contagion of the virus is that hand in hand with the spread of viruses is a spread of misinformation, and that, as you say, that can either be helpful, as in the case of Ebola, that people took it seriously, although you kind of wish that would have happened with climate change. In other cases, that misinformation can actually be really harmful.
Yeah, and I think certainly the speed of misinformation in this current outbreak and in others has often overtaken the outbreak itself. And it can be harmful. I mean, either because it distracts from useful message out there. For example, people have the wrong idea about what they should do if they're sick or where they should go. Or in some cases, more deeply, having that kind of misinformation can seed mistrust, and then people develop conspiracy theories and don't trust health agencies and won't listen to them. And all those things combined can make it much harder to control an outbreak.
Is there something that we can use from the mathematics of contagion to sort of spur on a craze or an idea? Like there are really influential people that people might not realize that, you know, men may not realize. Pip O'Connor, she's one of these people that spreads an idea really quickly. People love what she does. She tweets about something, it goes out, it's out of the shops the next day. Can we look at the maths of contagion and find a way of predicting how to make something go viral?
I think what you need to do, whether you're trying to stop something or get something to take off, is think about the steps in the transmission process. And particularly with online content, we've seen a lot more data, a lot more studies in recent years that have given us a really clear idea of what takes off and what potentially doesn't. And so if you think about transmission, first of all, it's the virus or the thing itself. So it's the kind of bit of content being being communicated or being spread. And we're seeing several features that are typically associated with stuff that's more viral. I mean, one is stuff that kind of triggers a strong emotional response, whether it's kind of, you know, awe in a science story or anger at something or kind of disgust. There's kind of really strong responses typically kind of dominate. I mean, another thing that is valued from an information point of view, and there's kind of an evolutionary benefit to it, is novelty. So it's new information we tend to value over information that we might know already. And that's because you know, throughout history, having information you didn't have before is a good thing. But that explains a lot of the kind of rise of fake news, that by definition, if you make up a story, it's going to be new because it didn't exist before. So that can explain why, for example, fake or false information spreads faster in many cases than true information. But it's not just about the content, you know, so the tweet or whatever you want to share. It's also the interactions that are kind of driving that spread. And that's, as you mentioned, you get kind of influential people. And what we're finding increasingly, that it's not just as simple as you target the high profile people. There's been kind of studies looking at this question of, do you go for high profile people or do you try and sort of spread out a bit and target a few more? And we're finding actually that if you want to reach a wider part of the network, it can actually be beneficial to try and almost kind of have a bit of a scattergun and a bit more randomness in the targeting. Because if you just focus on one high profile people, one high profile person, it might not kind of go beyond that. We find, for example, in Facebook data, this idea that people who are susceptible to ideas often aren't very influential, and people who are influential often aren't very susceptible. So if you think about that, that you might have a very high profile influential person, they tell lots of people, everyone's like, that's a great idea. And those people aren't good at persuading others. So that's why actually not just putting all your eggs in one basket and actually spreading out and sort of hitting more of the network can be more useful. So I think a combination of focusing on the content to make it more transmissible, but also thinking about how you're actually sparking the message in a population.
I know there's lots of theories about where this coronavirus came from. And, you know, if you Google it, half of them contradict each other. One saying it's from snakes, other saying it's not from snakes, and so on. Or pangolins, or bat soup, or whatever it is. How is it possible to rewind the clock using our model of mathematics and how things spread? Could you go back to the original case just using maths, or is that impossible?
We can. We can get, particularly from genetic data, pretty good estimates, especially once we have quite a lot of viruses to look at, because all viruses over time. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the sort of properties of infection change, but, you know, they just pick up errors in their genetic sequence. And so if you imagine over time this happening, the longer a virus has been circulating in a population, the more diversity, the more kind of variation in errors there are of all the viruses you see. So what this enables you to do is, using a kind of simple mathematical approach to how often you think these are occurring, you can kind of rewind backwards and work out, well, if we've got this diversity of viruses now, chances are it probably emerged at this point.
Really interesting stuff. As you're on, what's your prediction for this coronavirus? Will it go away in a couple of weeks? Are we doing what we should be doing?
I think we're projecting at the moment, based on kind of current trends, that in the center in Wuhan, that there may well be a peak in the coming weeks. I think the big question is what's going to happen internationally, that particularly in areas like Hong Kong and Singapore that are putting in really intense control measures. These places have dealt with these sort of things before. And if they can contain it, and if other countries can use similar methods successfully, I think potentially that we should be able to slow this down and hopefully have something that's manageable. I think if it turns out that the properties of the virus are such that this kind of intense contact tracing and following people up isn't enough to contain it, then I think we could have a situation where it could spread very widely.
Adam Kucharski, author of The Rules of Contagion, thanks very much.
Right, thank you.
Okay, it's time to look back at your emails and texts and tweets from last week, which we do. Last week we were talking about... It's funny, isn't it? Like the slightest change in intonation can just sound weird. Like when we think about all the things that go on in our lives, we've evolved just such precision with sound in our language alone. Just that one thing that, you know, that if you meet somebody and if they got the wrong intonation, it would totally put you off. Isn't like if I talked, you know, every once in a while, just had that, you know, slight increase of pitch in my voice that would drive you crazy. I mean, like everything else could be perfect. I could be the ideal mate for you, Aidan, but that one tiny, you know, change and you'd say I could never live with that.
You know that thing as well of every sentence being a question.
Oh yeah, That's an affliction of prosody. So I sometimes train people on communication, and one of the things that you don't have to talk to Kerry people about is the ups and downs of natural language, because they just have such musical voices in Kerry. But in Dundrum, there's this sort of spreading Americanization, and I get accused of it sometimes. And I know some guests on our program very much so, where they end a statement as it sounds like a question, and it goes up at the end, even though technically it's a statement, and that can be very irritating. The reason it's irritating is because the musicality of your voice aids comprehension, and people are expecting then further information, but you're actually finishing. So that's why it's annoying. Anyway, some communications geekiness there. We were talking about plastics with Professor Mark Miodovnik. He is doing a talk in the Northern Ireland Science Festival, which, by the way, if you are within 200 kilometres of, it's definitely worth a drive and a check out. There's lots of great stuff. And they have people who speak there that don't often speak very often in Dublin. We don't have that. We have the Festival of Curiosity, but we don't have a big science festival in the same way. So do check it out. Anyway, we were talking about plastics with Mark. And I was saying that we need to do this and we haven't done this and it's frustrating. And someone says, we have set up plastic recycling all over the UK and we would welcome a chat with Jonathan McRae. And I can almost sort of imagine at the end of that, there's like a cracking of knuckles. And I sort of feel like, you know, we'd welcome a chat with this Jonathan McRae. But I don't think you mean it that way. I think we want to spread the message of your recycling rather than I've said something to upset you and you're going to hit me with a crowbar. So I will get in touch with you, Padraig. I mean, do you ever get those? Do you ever get someone says, oh, I'd love to meet you up for a coffee sometime. And you say, yeah, sure. And then you realize they ring you up and they say, so when's our coffee? And you go, oh, you really want to actually have a coffee. And then you agree out of niceness and also just mild curiosity to have a coffee. And then you realize they're actually just, there's no agenda, which I find, you know, with people you meet through business is kind of strange. But it's kind of like, oh, let's meet for, do you ever have those?
I think it's a uniquely Irish thing to say, yeah, sure, but I actually have no intention of turning up. I've found people around Irish are like, what is that?
Well, because it's sort of a, oh, we should meet up soon. It's basically saying, I like you and, you know, this was enjoyable. It's, you know, which you can't say that out loud. That's weird to say that to somebody. Oh, this was fun and you made me feel happy inside. You don't say that. So you say, oh, you know, let's get a coffee sometime. Yeah, sounds great. Okay, bye. See, never see him again. And that's just a nice way of ending it. It's like it's a rounded edge goodbye as opposed to a blunt or jagged edge goodbye. But I've had a couple of people say, let's meet for a coffee. How does Thursday sound? And I'm like, okay, so there's going to be some business venture that, or, you know, there's something's going to happen in this meeting. And then I realize, you know, 15 minutes into my carrot cake, who am I kidding? The carrot cake is gone in the first 30 seconds. But like 15 minutes into the coffee, I'm like, this is a meeting for no reason. Happened to me, actually, do you know, a listener, one of the things that I love about this job, right, is that lots of people just randomly say, oh, I love the show. And it's lovely. And they recognize me by my voice. They don't know me from the many TV programs I've done, which nobody watched. But they recognize the voice. And I was at the match on Saturday and I asked a fella, I said, excuse me, there's no taxis. And I said, listen, are you going into town? I'll share a taxi with you. And he goes, Jonathan. And I said, yes. And he said, how's it going, Damien? A big fan of the show. And I was like, what? One sentence came out of my voice. And then it was lashing rain. And so we ended up going for drinks in the Four Seasons. That's where you get a taxi from, apparently. So we had a drink at the Four Seasons. How random. But there was one of those, oh, let's go for a drink. I was like, okay. Now, in fairness, I had a few drinks on me at that stage. So I'd say yes to probably anything. Damien could have taken that all the way to the suite. Anyway. That was not his intention, by the way. He's married and he has it. No, I don't mean, yeah. Anyway, God, we're getting lawsuits now. Lovely fella, anyway. He said he'd give me a call. Not in that way. We ended up having a business conversation. Anyway, you don't need to know that. Now you know. We were talking about Lonesome George, the tortoise. In the Galapagos, they seem to have found, because, you know, when Lonesome George died, everyone was like, oh, man, because it was the last tortoise of its kind. Although, you know, all tortoises kind of look the same to you and me. But obviously, it's awful when it's, I mean, like, obviously,
you
it's
can't
awful.
Say that.
Well, look, let me tell you something, right? The definition of a species, you find someone to define a species. We've got a problem with taxonomy in the world. That's all I'm saying. Now, obviously, I don't think all tortoises are tortoises, but, you know, taxonomists, am I wrong? So anyway, Lonesome George died, and that was, I was very upset at the time, but they found a tortoise. It's kind of like Lonesome George, and they're going to see if they can bring him back. Someone says, sorry for not texting earlier. I've been driving. Very good, Kieran. The collective noun for tortoises is a boardroom. Thank you. Have we fact checked this?
Actually, no.
We asked what a
you did ask.
What a collective noun for tortoises is, and someone says a boardroom. Is that can't be right. I'm looking at you to Google. Yes, I'm looking at you to Google, please, Aidan. John in Tipperary says hybrid vigor increases longevity. Is that is he trying to sell us Cialis there, or what is going on with that text? Any idea? Is he talking about like mixing the two different tortoise species that they found on that mountain? I don't know. We were talking about election, and someone says, big day for Fine Gael. Hopefully they get their bums kicked for the conceited disrespect for the Irish people, and nasty Leo will be back in opposition, which suits his condescending, dismissive, personal. This is, why are we reading this out? This is just someone randomly texting in about Fine Gael on election day. Okay. The climate change thing sort of disappeared suddenly, didn't it? What happened? What the hell? What the hell? I thought this was like a. I thought we were all on board with this. The climate change is the number one issue. This no, it's not. Seventh issue. After, I don't know, lots of other things. Health is obviously important. Housing and homelessness extremely important. But I thought climate change. I thought we thought climate change was important. Someone else texted in this text, which we get these random texts. Brendan, did you hear of County Clare? Did I miss it? Love to know what was going on there. You could do a whole show on just random texts and just recreating the scene as to how that sentence got texted from one person to another. Right, that's it from us for this week. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey for producing, researching.
Oh, wait, I didn't tell you about the tortoises.
Oh, wait, yeah, sorry, this tortoise. Well, you just take so long to Google. Yeah. Come on.
I actually forgot about it.
It's great. Well, I have real confidence that other people are listening. If my own fucking producer can't be bothered to listen to the program.
No sign of it anyway as a collective noun, if that makes you feel any better.
Maybe this is one of those things that Kieran has bought because someone who he liked and respected told him, and he hasn't gone to fact check it himself. Maybe Kieran's been telling everyone that the collective noun for tortoises is a boardroom, and it's just not true. We're going to have to fact check that, Kieran, and apparently it takes 15 minutes to Google something. So
found out what the actual collective noun is.
Okay, what is the actual collective noun?
A creep of tortoises.
A creep of tortoises.
Yeah.
That seems unfair and slightly.
I guess it's referencing the way they move.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's play out with
Let's
creep.
Just get the hell out of here. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Simon Keane researching, Jojo Cardozo on sound. We'll be back next Saturday with a fresh edition of the main show, but otherwise you'll hear Future Proof Gold and Future Proof Extra in the coming week in your podcast feed.